it's Danielle Fishel,
Ryder Strong,
and Will Friedle from Pod Meets World.
Does Friendly have a taste? If it does, it's probably like Hello's peppermint-flavored anti-plaque and whitening toothpaste.
Brush away plaque, show tartar who's boss, and remove surface stains to naturally whiten.
Hello's thoughtful and flavor-forward products make brushing your teeth feel like a confetti-filled bathroom dance party.
So say hello to Hello with the always cruelty-free, never tested on animals toothpaste that's made to spread smiles.
Visit HelloProducts.com and let Hello add some everyday yay into your life.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hi folks, how are you doing? I hope this finds you well. What have you been watching? I'd love to know what you've either seen at the cinema, if you've been and allowed yourself that luxury of being enveloped by that big screen and that surround sound. We'd love to know what you've seen, whether it be on the big screen or whether it be on the small screen. I was lucky enough to see the new Joker film this week. And that is in anticipation of an upcoming Joker 2, Folie à Deux. Apologise for my terrible French accent. I'm so excited. I don't want to say who might be coming on, just in case I jinx it, because, hey folks, that's happened in the past on numerous occasions. But I've seen the film, and let me just say that watching Joaquin Phoenix tap dance might be one of the most joyful things I've ever seen on screen. Anyway, that's that. And I can't wait to hopefully talk about it in the coming weeks. One thing that I wanted just to selfishly publicise and talk about is a brand new project that I've been working on for about a year, actually. It's called Be In The Scene, BITS for short. And you can head on to the website, beintheScene.com, to dive into it. And the idea is that it's an immersive experience for film and TV. We've launched it with one map for the Outrun, which is coming out this week, in fact, this Friday. And it's a way of showing you and sharing with you locations and places, exclusive content, behind the scenes, deep dives and layers of information about people and places and themes to do with the film. So it's just the start, and we are very excited about the possibilities of what it can be. And about involving you, the film community, the TV community, because we know how much joy you can get out of getting all those kind of, I don't know, deep dives and more information about the films and TV shows that you love. So if you've got the time, please do go and check it out. We're also up on socials, which we will be filling with things over the next couple of weeks. We're called Be In The Scene, BITS for short. So yeah, get involved, go and find us, and sign up for our newsletter, for which we're going to reveal loads of things over the next couple of weeks. So yeah, so that's a very exciting new project that I'm very excited to develop and take to weird and wonderful places. And it is not going to interfere with soundtracking, because soundtracking is my absolute pride and joy that I love bringing to you every week, sometimes twice a week, which we are definitely going to be doing over the next couple of weeks. We've also loved doing our brilliant soundtracking Everyman Film Club events, and we did one of those just last night as I'm recording this for The Critic, which is a lovely little movie that came out in cinemas on, I think it came out on Friday, in fact, and it's directed by Anand Tucker, and it stars Sir Ian McKellen, Gemma Arterton, Mark Strong. The cast in it is fantastic. We were so thrilled and slightly gobsmacked to be joined by Anand and Sir Ian McKellen for an Everyman Soundtrack and Film Club last night. So I look forward to sharing that conversation with you over the next couple of weeks. But this week's episode is from one of those film clubs, and it features director and writer Coralie Forget, Margaret Qualley, and actual Demi Moore. They joined me in front of a live audience to discuss Coralie's new film, The Substance. Now, I'm sure you have seen something about this film somewhere. I don't want to say too much about it because it's one of those films that the experience of watching the film is as much of the entertainment as the film itself. But it tells the story of a fading celebrity, Elizabeth Sparkle, played by Demi, who decides to use a black market drug that temporarily creates a younger, better version of herself, unknowingly giving her horrifying side effects. Now, this film is a physical experience. It will make you feel uncomfortable, but the film is so many things. I think it's brave, terrifying, it's entertaining. It throws up so many brilliant questions about age, about the kind of pressures that are put on women in particular, about how they should look, what comes from a male gaze. I mean, just so many questions. It is such a great experience. Not for the faint-hearted, but you know what? Just get yourself to a cinema to experience it. It's scored by British composer and producer Rafferty, and we're going to begin with his cue, Alteration. Being here, and huge congratulations on this film. It's so great coming in a room and feeling the energy from an audience once they've just experienced something like this. I hope you feel it too. I'm going to start with you, Coralie, if it's okay. What sparked this idea? What sparked you wanting to tell this story and write it in the first place?
Like you said, I was not far away from turning 50. I was maybe 45 or 42 when I started to write. And it was a moment where I violently felt that, you know, I was going to be erased from society and be worse nothing anymore. And when I reflected on that thought, I thought, oh, how crazy it is to kind of think this as hopefully I'm not at the middle of my life. And I really wanted to address this and to find a way to get out of this powerful jail that those kind of thoughts have as violent effect on you. And when I thought a little bit further, I felt like, in fact, at every age of my life, I think since I'm a little girl, I was led to feel that something was not good enough. Like, you know, that I needed to look better. I didn't have, let's say at some age, the right body, the right weight, you know, and there is always something that you can feel about yourself that is not validated by society. So for me, it was the need to kind of let this violence that I was facing, I think, since I'm a kid, go out, to kind of say, okay, this is, you know, this is it. look at that. And to, yeah, take it outside, what everything, you know, I was led to feel in the inside.
In terms of the kind of the tone of the film, in the way that, you know, you choose horror as a way of kind of really addressing these issues, it's such a double-edged sword, because it's such a beautiful way, but it's also such a grotesque way. So you have that kind of almost kind of parallels of it as well. When you're writing something like that, because there isn't a ton of dialogue in the film, but when you're writing something like that, how do you get that on a page? How do you create that world? How do you create these characters?
Really, I let myself guide by the images and the sounds, and because I really visualize what I'm going to film when I write the film. And I know that everything that comes on the page comes from a reason. I can't explain it at the moment I'm writing it, but I know that the way the ideas come are meaning something, you know? And that's why also during the shooting, I kind of stick to the way those ideas was formed. Or sometimes it's a color that I'm super attached to. Sometimes it's a rhythm. Sometimes, you know, because I know that deep down they mean something, and usually I kind of analyze it after the movie it's done, and you know, everything start to make sense. And as you said, there is really little dialogue in the movie, and it was the same way in my previous film. So to me, I really love to tell the story through symbolism, like finding the symbols that kind of tell the story and what I feel in the most heightened way. And that's why I chose the figure of the actress to kind of tell the story that I think as every woman we're led to, you know, live. Because being an actress is putting yourself, you know, in front of the eyes of everyone and seeking love outside of yourself in the way people look at you, in the attention that you get that from this, and the fact that you are led to think that this is the only validation that you have. And when this goes away, it's like your whole world, you know, that collapse. And so, yeah, that's why I think this symbol of the actress, of Elizabeth Sparkle in the film, for me was the best metaphor to kind of tell about the experience of, I think, we are all led to live in our lives.
Yeah. Demi, how did this script arrive with you, and what was your initial reaction when you read it and read this part?
Well, I was extremely moved. I felt like this was such a unique way of delving into this very important subject matter. I mean, everything that Coralie was just describing, I think, is heightened by it being in the setting of it being an actress in the world of Hollywood, where there is a lot of externalized pressure. But what really struck me was how human it was. Like, it was relatable to me for not just women, but for just us as humans. That idea of that compare and despair, and that, you know, constant lack of not measuring up. And, you know, not so much ironically now in my life, but in my younger years, which I had, you know, shared about, I walked through a lot of that. And the part that really moved me in the story was not the circumstances as much as the violence that was being held against oneself. And I think that the way in which it moved to the body horror aspect was really like seeing this image. If you were to take how we can speak so horribly to ourselves, if you could take that and create an image of it, it would be in this distorted, particularly for Elizabeth, as I degrade throughout, like as I'm trying to chase some ideal of perfection that is an illusion. And as you're doing that, you're losing the very essence of the beauty of who you really are. And I loved that the message ultimately was about self-love and acceptance.
It's a beautiful kind of double act that you have, because I imagine that there's a lot of your scenes that are together. I mean, I just wanted to say, to commend you on your fearlessness with these roles, really, in terms of the kind of submitting yourself to what was really needed for us as an audience to feel, to see, and to understand what the characters were kind of going through. How did you both get there to that point to feel that you could submit to the roles, submit to these characters and the relationship between these two women?
I always feel like it's kind of the only option. Like, yeah, you're super damned if you don't, you know? if I do, I might also be damned. But if I don't, then I'm super damned, you know? So the landscape of this movie was one in which you kind of just had to floor it every time. Stylistically, it's dialed up. To be a part of this movie at all, I think we both knew that and knew what was being asked of us, mm-hmm. and just had to kind of be like, well, here you go.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, whenever we step out of our comfort zone is actually when we have the greatest opportunity for growth and expansion of ourselves and I think in our work. And I think she also was very specific in the script and really kind of had laid things out. I mean, we read it all on the page. Granted, there are things that read easier, like 6 to 9 hours of prosthetics doesn't quite spell out in a script. Or, you know, being stuck in a suit where only one eye is being shown. But I think that it's also part of the joy of taking on a role like this to not really go balls to the wall is like you're missing out on the best part of it. And that doesn't mean it isn't really hard. I mean, this was really, it was hard. Yeah. Emotionally, it required a lot of vulnerability and rawness and, you know, moments that weren't comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Margot, your character is playing a version of Elizabeth in a way to kind of find that, but also find her, you know, she has this kind of wonderful sort of almost kind of satanic perfection kind of in a way, which is brilliant. Finding that, you know, in terms of kind of not emulating Elizabeth, but Elizabeth's got to be within her somewhere. But then also her own journey as well. How did you kind of navigate that and working with Demi on that as well?
Yeah, well, you know, I think she's so naive in the beginning because she's entering this body like without a childhood or without like a teenagehood. So it's kind of how I'm thinking about it, right? Yeah. Like without all of the experiences that make us understand empathy and compassion. And so it's not really until she becomes the monster that she understands love for the first time. Yeah, it's a strange thing to play, honestly. Like you love Elizabeth. I'm a hateful girl. I'm a naughty, naughty girl.
How were the, you know, like the exercise classes? The way that you've shot that is so brilliant, you know, in terms of the sort of sensual nature of kind of sort of watching that record of those classes and stuff. And we see Elizabeth do that first, but then we see it heightened and kind of really kind of sexualized even more in a way as well. How many hours? How many days? What are we talking
about? How many tears? Okay.
Yeah. Well, we shot the whole thing really fast. It was 2 days total for that section, which in the landscape of this movie is like really fast. We shot this for 5 months, but the things that take the longest are like the inserts and just like things you wouldn't expect sometimes. So yeah, when I first learned that, I was like, no fucking way. It was mortifying. I don't know if anyone's ever been in like a dance class and been like, well, I can't do that.
I think we all have.
Yeah, it was that, like, it was the worst case scenario. I walked into a bunch of like young dancers who knew their routine. I was the only person who didn't know it, and they're teaching it to me. And I was just like, I like trying to do it and ran to the bathroom and started sobbing and was like, all right, I think I need one person in here if I'm going to humiliate myself. And everyone left and I had to like learn one-on-one with the teacher and then practice every day until we got there to try to make that seem like something that came naturally to me.
Absolute pro now. Absolute pro.
Thank you.
What was the reality of shooting that? You know, did you have the music kind of pre-cleared to play what you wanted to have in there? Was that already in there?
Yeah, basically the Pump It Up song was like a very important part, like of telling this part of the story, because it's like brings such a kind of sexy vibes, hyper sexualized vibe, and the name in itself, like Pump It Up, there is this underlying sexual, you know, connotation. Mm. And I think, yes, the Sue's character is really like, basically she falls into the same trap that then Elizabeth, like there is this pleasure of course, being young again, like living through this new body where you feel so powerful and everything is smooth and easy, but also kind of feeling like it's going to be your best chance again to be seen and to be loved is like to be hypersexual or to be like the ultimate fantasy that, you know, having those eyes watching at you. I think I was very influenced by, you know, also all the video clips that I was grew up with, where it was the kind of incarnation of, this is what is valued. This is, you know, what is supposed to feel powerful. And in a way, you know, I'm totally fine with that. Like, that's fine. I think it becomes problematic when you feel that's the only way you have to be seen, to be valued, and it becomes some sort of jail that, you know, you follow because you feel you don't have a choice. Mm. And the Pump It Up music has this kind of repetitive vibe that kind of say this, like, there is no other choice, like, you know,
gotta pump it up. Exactly. It's the only lyric
it's playing in our heads right now.
Sorry, I'm really sorry to bring it up again.
And I think for Margaret to get that right, like the body part of the work was such an important part of the Sue character. There was all this body training that she worked on to kind of shape this amazing body. We worked also with prosthetic. It was like really shaping the perfect incarnation of what is supposed to be perfect in a certain type of gaze. And I think that dancing was also a way to incarnate that. So it was definitely one of the super important part of the way that the character can express this. So, yeah, it was definitely a lot of work, a lot of practice. I know that Margaret, like, trained, like, every day obsessively to get all the choreography right and to... indeed arrive on set as if it was like her, you know, as she was born like that.
You got to pump it up, don't you know, pump it up. You got to pump it up, don't you know, pump it up. You got to pump it up, don't you know, pump it up. You got to pump it up, don't you know, pump it up. You got to pump it up, don't you know, pump it up. You got to pump it up, don't you know, pump it up. You got to pump it up, don't you know, pump it up. You got to pump it up, don't you know, pump it up. You got to pump it up, don't you know, pump it up. You got to pump it up, don't you know, pump it up. You got to pump it up, don't you know, pump it up. You got to pump it up, don't you know.
That's, I think, what we do is, yeah, like, repeat things or prep things so much that we feel that we've just created it. And that's what I like also about what we do. Like, it's a lot of work to the very little details, whether it's prosthetic, whether it's dancing, whether it's, like, the transformation things where some things took us, like, 2 weeks to shoot, like, and I think that's specifically what the movie language, like, it's so visual, it's so without dialogues that everything matters, and that's the way we crafted it.
I love the kind of the transformation of Elizabeth, you know, and the kind of physicality and the change in the physicality of the character, and, you know, the cooking scene and all that. It's just, it's really the way that you kind of inhabit those kind of scenes. Is that a real joy as an actor to have a role like that, that is really physical, you know, and you've really got to kind of show the character and the journey and the story in a way rather than speak it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was an aspect that I hadn't really thought about until we got there, of just that aspect of degrading down my back, being, you know, and having to walk around at full days, you know, hunched over. And in a weird way, it was very liberating. I've said it to Margaret too. I feel like in so many ways, like, being able to show up and know it's okay to look like shit, but allowing myself also to share the parts of myself that maybe you prefer not everybody to see, and let go of what other people might think. And so in that way of actually allowing it to be physicalized, ultimately, while it was a contracting experience doing it, it was actually a very expansive one at the end.
Was it almost kind of not therapeutic in a way, but did you, would you say you learned something, you know, as humans through this experience and what the characters were experiencing?
I think really, I mean, I can just speak for myself. I feel like that there was a very liberating aspect. Granted, after a month of prosthetics that were literally like anywhere from 6 to 9 hours and, wow. You know, the costumes, the heat, the all of it, and being able to shed that was equally liberating.
Get rid of that yellow coat.
Oh, my God. I could have killed Coralie over that fucking yellow coat. Let me just say, we were shooting in Cannes in the middle of summer, and I was in a wool winter coat.
Telling you, sometimes things are coming. I don't know why, but I know they
wool
matter.
Wool winter coat.
My mind was blown that you filmed it in Cannes.
Yeah, to me, the idea was like not to create a real LA, but to create the LA of our unconscious collective mind, because I think everyone has an image of Hollywood in his mind, even those who've never been there. And to me, it was really about using this as a symbol, you know, that would incarnate the whole world, you know, as if this area was a representation of our whole world in just a heightened way. So to me, the fact not to shoot there was a gift, like, because it allowed me to create my own version of a Hollywood, which is basically blue sky and palm tree. Like, and that's the type of freedom I love in a shooting. That's, you know, also the kind of tricks that you just need, okay, a pink wall, palm trees, and there it is. You can say you're in Hollywood. I really love those tricks. And after, of course, it's a lot of much more like thinking about how we're going to do that view in the apartment. Which technique are we going to use to not have the actors playing in front of a green screen, which is the thing I hate the most. So we kind of work so hard to know the best technique we would choose, whether it's going to be like the soft drop or the more numeric like LED screens, and the old technique turned out to be the best. Like the view you see in the movie is just a picture of LA printed on a
Wow. It's a photograph.
It's a photo. Wow. Printed on a curtain, like elevated curtain, but still a curtain that is lit in a very special way. And me, I remember the first time I entered the set, the first time it was like put, I was like, oh my God, I'm there. I'm really like, that's when I knew, you know, we succeeded in creating this, because the locations in the film, in my previous film too, are a character of the movie. They have their own identity. They represent feelings, they represent their symbols of what the characters go through, and they kind of set the tone of, you know, the world not being realistic and taking you into a way where you can accept the excess, where you can accept to kind of live reality. And to kind of jump on the question before, that's the part of freedom that I give myself into the movie, mm-hmm. like to create the very own rules for the film.
With the ending, do you give yourself, as a filmmaker and a storyteller, there are no boundaries. You know, you create your own boundaries as to where you go, sort of thing. With the way that you chose to end the film, which I absolutely love, I just love that spray in the audience with blood. It's so brilliant. It's awesome. Do you give yourself parameters? Do you just kind of go, you know, when you're writing it, or does it adapt? Does it change when you're in pre-production and then when you're shooting? But I guess with something like that, you have to have it locked in.
When I write, I really don't give myself any boundaries. And after, like, it's true that my obsession is really to try to incarnate as much, you know, what I have written on the page, because I know that everything is linked, everything has a rhythm for a specific reason, and each scene worked because everything, you know, has been thought about a certain way. And the ending, I think, was kind of, I think, two things meeting each other, like the kind of liberating moment to be able to kind of, okay, let go everything that you tend to keep with yourself, like, you know, be polite and delicate and behave and smile, of course, always smile, and then like let it go and to not care. But also for me, it was a very powerful symbolical way to say, this is all yours. Like, you know, this is like what society does. That's, I think, why the scene came to me that way.
So good. Did you have any films or filmmakers, both that inspired you going into this and that you guys watched in preparation for this at all, you know, in terms of not homework as such, but more just kind of framework, I guess?
Yeah, there were a few films we discussed with Demi, I remember, when we started to talk about the film, to prep, and it was a lot about, I think, all the body work, which to me was very important in the movie, which were the center of film that I really admired, such as Requiem for a Dream or The Joker, like, you know, the kind of body transformation that you experience. I remember also mentioning movies like Wild at Heart or The Fly. Yeah, all, and I remember that Demi was very responsive to looking at those parts that were created in also very bodywork part. And then I think it's like, you know, general inspirations that you use to talk about like what you're going to create in the very specific language of the film. But I think there are kind of foundations that are kind of helpful to start, yeah, sharing a language about what's in your head and what you want to transmit to one another.
Again, one of the interesting things is when you're doing something that doesn't have a lot of dialogue, it was so important for me to feel like I had done a lot of the work before even arriving, so that it was very alive all of the time, because we do say so much even when we're not saying any words. And that can really be very different in such subtle ways. That's all I've got on that one.
I'll say Instagram, yeah. And TikTok meet like Elephant Man.
Wow, I like that.
I mean, my other, since you brought that up, it makes me think of like when people have said, well, what is this movie? And it's so impossible to try to like put it into something to see. I said, well, it isn't entirely this, but if you do The Picture of Dorian Gray with Death Becomes Her and a Jane Fonda workout, you might get an idea.
Shake.
Yeah, like a cocktail. Yeah, I like that. It's great. Just before we finish, I want to talk quickly about music. We mentioned the Pump It Up track, but working with a brilliant British composer called Rafferty.
Yeah, that was such a great collaboration. Like, I always have a very strong, you know, feeling about music when I write, because I really listen to a lot of music, you know, while I'm writing. It's also what kind of sets the tone of the film. That's one of the big element. And in fact, for many different reasons, like, the composer arrived on the film like really, really late. Like, so for, you know, a long time, I work in the edit with kind of, you know, temp music. And I knew that I needed a composer that would, you know, kind of enter the register of the film and would succeed to kind of give the rawness and the kind of violence and the kind of energy that the movie was about. And I think it's quite a good time that it wasn't there from the beginning, because the editing took so long, like almost a year and a half.
Wow.
Yes, that, you know, or a year maybe. No, maybe a year and a half. That, you know, you can lose your energy being on board like so mm-hmm. early in the process, because there is a whole, I would say, kind of experimental process, you know, where you test a lot of things. And to me, the music is a little bit like instant thing, instant mm-hmm. energy that you get it and then you have to release, you know, even if it's a lot of work. So when I met with Rafferty, I met him for this movie, and I was really, what struck me was at the same time the very electronic kind of violence, roughness that his music had, but also in some of his tracks, extreme, sensitive, emotional pieces that he was doing. And to me, the mix of both like really moved me in such a deep way. And I think, like, you know, he managed to recreate this in the movie, and it was such a great collaboration. The kind of crazy part of it is that we never met before the screening in Cannes. Everything was done remotely, working by Zoom, because we were in such a time frame that, you know, we didn't have time for me to go to London or for him to come to Paris. So you know what was funny is, like, wow, I just saw him through a screen, and I don't know why, like, as he was I always saw him seated, and I thought he was I've never seen, and when I saw him in real life, I was like, ooh, oh, you're so tall. I don't know why I had pictured him like being so much smaller than what he's in real, and it was such a great moment to be able to hug for real, because I think we were both super happy about the collaboration. And that's what the kind of the magic of the, you know, unexpected happens, because, like, it was super stressful to have a composer on board so late in the process. But I think he loved the movie so much, like, he had the energy that the movie needed. And that's, yeah, a really great meeting for me in collaboration in the movie.
And the Bernard Herrmann vertical piece was a perfect choice.
Yes, and I think in itself it embodies so much of, you know, past, present, like unconscious collective mind that says a lot. Yeah.
We've run out of time. Thank you so, so much for being here to talk to me about your extraordinary film. We really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Huge congratulations, please.
Thank you.
Thank you to Margaret. Thank you, Demi. Thank you, Coralie.
From the score to the substance, that's On Air, rounding off this latest episode of our Everyman Soundtrack and Film Club with Coralie Farge, Margaret Qualley and Demi Moore. My huge thanks to all three for joining me in front of an audience, to everyone at Everyman who facilitated it, and the team at Mubi as well for being absolutely brilliant. The Substance is on general release right now, so get along and see it if you can. If body horror is your thing, then we've actually got quite a few episodes up on edithbowman.com on that subject, including Julia Docornieu on her incredible film Titan. You can follow us on your socials, we're at Soundtracking UK, and please do subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is called Soundtracking Extra. Next up, we have the first of a few bonus episodes on the horizon. Now, at the start of the episode, I was talking about our new project Be In The Scene, which we have launched with the wonderful Outrun. Now, the Outrun was a book originally released by Amy Liptrot, and she has worked with director Nora Fingscheidt on this phenomenal film. So Nora and Amy have written the screenplay, Nora's directed it, and it stars Saoirse Ronan as the lead character, Rona. And I'm so thrilled that on next week's episode, you can hear Amy, Nora, Saoirse and also Papa Esidu all talking about their phenomenal film The Outrun, which hits cinemas on the 27th of September. Join me next week then for an Outrun special. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
Has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the East and North sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
If you've been thinking about getting serious with your money, like actually serious, now's the time. The Motley Fool is offering new members 50% off their iconic stock recommendation service, Stock Advisor. This is the same service that's crushed the market with recommendations that have returned 1,057% since inception, compared to the S&P 500's 180% over that same period. This isn't guesswork. The Motley Fool has a track record of finding companies before they become household names. So if you want to invest smarter and you like saving money while doing it, go to fool.com/listen to claim your 50% off discount off a 1-year term of Stock Advisor. Again, that's fool.com/listen. Returns of 1,057% are from the Motley Fool's product Stock Advisor and measured against S&P 500 returns of 180% as of July 10th, 2025. Past performance is not an indicator of future results. All investing involves a risk of loss. Individual investment results may vary.